So basically, give us a write-up of everything we've talked about on the blackboard with links and references. The idea is like look at a kind of generic optimization problem, then define what we've said about objective function constraints, variables, scale of problems, so that we can, using those definitions, we can define the problem types that are solved by software packages. So it's a lot of terminology. There is not a lot of theory. Today will be more theory heavy. And below the three approaches that you're going to encounter in software, the first one is when you specify the like the solver will call your functions to compute the objective and constraints. And below, like the list of all algorithms you could use if your problem is of that form. Some other problem have a canonical form. This is what we are going to see today for linear programs. What's good about those forms that the problem is fully specified by just a few matrices and vectors. Again, a list of solvers. Hi. And finally, a few words on modeling frameworks. If you look at the source code of last week, we use, for example, Jump or Convex. So there's a description of what this framework do. And everything has been done for MATLAB and Julia. I'm not a specialist of Python, and I was not keen on like learning another language just to write. But Python has a few things. Python tends to be much more comprehensive for machine learning, if that's what strikes your fancy. I'm not a machine learning person, so, and I put a few words on the exact methods. So you have that, like keep it aside. One day you need to solve an optimization problem, you have basically the list of more or less everything you can do. I think we should start, and I'd like to have like people in the first two rows so that if I need to jump in and give you instruction, I can do that. For today, I completely changed my method. Like last time I taught in a way that I would teach people in my group, and I didn't find it work out so well. I realized like this course is better suited to a bit more formal style of teaching. So this is what we are going to do. Everything is based on Jupyter Notebooks. I just have one problem with Jupyter Notebooks. They can be finicky about putting images, putting references for equations. But this is what I need if I want to refer to things. So what I did was to provide you the notebook so you can play with the code, but you have also like the export in LaTeX and the PDF. So what I'm going to do while I'm explaining things, I'm going to use the PDF files. Hi. And please come in the first two rows so that it's easier for me to jump in. There will be more exercise this way. I was saying that I updated the GitHub repository. You now have like the source code for and the notebooks for today's lecture, the notes of last Monday lecture. And I'm going to like explain the theory using the PDF file, which contains the equation numbering and so on. But if you want to run the examples, you have to use the Jupyter notebook. But they will be kind of slightly broken for equations and figures. So now what we are going to do is to consider only convex optimization problems. So basically, convex optimization, and now I need to be extremely careful about timing. Convex optimization problem, this is the canonical form. And in that form, we require that all functions are convex. And what's convexity? It's basically if you take your function and you pick two points, then the value of any point in the line segment is basically dominated by okay, I will use a figure, it's easier. So here is a 1D function of one variable x. But you could extend that to a function of two variables and just think that you have a plane and the function value is the points up. A function is convex. One way to think of it is that the set of values that are above the function is convex. Or you can also see that if you pick two points, you draw a straight line between those two points. And the function is below. What's really, really cool when you have and on the right, there's an example of a non-convex function. What's really cool with convex functions, that to optimize those functions, you just need to follow the slope. Think of like putting a marble and let it roll and stop. And it will stop on a minimum, and it will always be the global minimum of your function. If you have a function that's non-convex, you basically have to jump over parts to go to a better minimum. And solvers, they usually don't have the intelligence to do that. So I put below convex set, same thing. If it's not a set and not a function, and you pick any two points in the set, the line segment between the two is going to be inside. If it's not convex, then there are at least a pair of points such that the line segment is not inside. And this is the thing that solver, when they encounter non-convex set, sometimes they, if they only have information about the neighborhood of iterates, they don't have the intelligence of going around a constraint. So those solvers, they don't necessarily give you optimum solutions, like globally optimum solutions. So we focus on convex programs because they give us guarantees. We run them through a solver, we will get a value, and up to numerical precision, this is the global optimum we are looking. There are many, many variants of convex programs. One person last time mentioned semi-definite optimization, which is something that we use a lot in quantum information. Not going to do that. I'm just going to consider linear programs, linear optimization. And basically, all functions are linear. It's a bit an abuse of terminology because something linear should not have a constant term. It's more like affine functions. But everybody makes that confusion, so I'm going to keep it. And one example of a linear program would be this one. I have a linear combination of three real variables. They should all be non-negative, and I have one equality constraint. I could draw the...
On the upper slide, you said something less than equal to zero.
It's the same thing. Like, it could be minus, 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 less or equal than zero. Indeed, good point. Linear functions, you can flip the sign. They are convex and concave. So it doesn't matter like which direction it goes. Up there, where you could have like things that are not linear, it's important to have like the sign, the correct direction. I'm actually using greater or equal than zero here for a reason that will become clear later, is when we use the duality, it makes signs easier. And that's the way things will be written. Just to say, what's the feasible set of this? I could not figure out how to plot 3D stuff with Julia. But basically, things are non-negative, so you're in that non-negative ortant. And at 1, 1, 1, that's your hyperplane. You're basically on that little triangle. Now, how do we formulate those programs? So you have a bit of code here. The cool thing with the toolbox convex.jl that you can use whatever thing Julia provides you. Like even like the sum, you don't need to write x1 plus x2 plus x3. When you say a vector is greater or equal than zero, it means like every component. So there are lots of useful things to make your life a bit more nice. And you can just like the rest is just ceremonial, and the way you recover values also like a bit of ceremonial. I provided that, so you can just run this on your computer, and you should get the optimal value, which, if I remember correctly, is minus one. There we realize that Julia needs to compile a lot of stuff every time you run something. Boom. Objective, minus one. Optimal point, it picked the one with the z-coordinate here. Okay. Remember last time I said that for general optimization problems, you could provide the function that will compute the objective, that will compute the constraint for any given x. It turns out for linear and the gradient of those things. Turns out that for linear program, the gradient is always trivial. It's like the gradient of the objective would be 1, 2, minus 1. Linear programs have a lot of structure. So actually, solver that solve linear program, they won't call user-defined functions to compute all these things. what you just do, what they will tell you is that, hey, here is the form I expect for you to provide me, and it's what I'm going to solve. And if what you have is not exactly of that form, you have to wiggle a little bit the program and the constraint to make it fit, which is basically what convex.jl is doing. And then the solver will solve the problem in its canonical form. So I based this tutorial on the Mosaic cookbook. Mosaic has awesome documentation. I basically stole their examples so that you can go to that book. It will be more detailed, and everything will match. But of course, I adapted everything for Julia. So the standard form of a linear program, it will be defined with three data structures, like a vector, a matrix, and another vector. The objective will just be a dot product. Remember, we add the possibility of a constant term, but that will not change where the minimum lies. So we just get rid of the constant term. You want to do a maximization? You can't. You could always like replace C by minus C and replace maximization by minimization. Variable X, real numbers, equality constraint, and we impose a condition that those variables are non-negative. You're going to tell me, but maybe I want to do X greater or equal than minus one. So now if you get those kind of things, you have to be creative and introduce additional variables. I just made it so that the problem that we are going to have today, they map to that standard form. But there are ways to introduce additional variables, and they're called stacked variables, to make any linear constraint fit in that form. So now what you have to do, I basically rewrote the vote here like a little bit of ceremonial for a linear program in the canonical form. And what you have to do is to provide those data matrices and vectors to solve what we had above. Just remember one thing, that's Julia stuff. If you have brackets and you put commas inside, this will give a one-dimensional data structure. If you put either like spaces or colons, it will be a matrix, because Julia distinguishes between n-dimensional vectors and n times one or one times n matrices. So just be careful what you use here. It should have the same shape as. Mm-hmm. So maybe let's look at it like together. So X will be, I think, you know, matrix vector product will be interpreted as a column vector. But C is a column vector. So what we're going to use, so the problem was x1 plus x2 minus x3, so it's 1, 2, minus 1. 1, 2, minus 1. A is going to be like the equality constraint. It's 1, 1, 1 equal 1. So that's going to be 1, 1, 1 equal 1. And that should work. Yes. So the font size, how is it going for you, actually? Good? Could be a bit better, right? There we go. So I use a column vector for C. Probably it would have worked with like just a one-dimensional thing as well. A is a row matrix. If you try to use a vector for A, you'll be pretty sad. Just to show you, I think. C I can probably replace by a vector, that will work as well. Yes. But now if I try to replace A by a vector, I'm going to be very sorry. So I absolutely need to use the row matrix syntax for that. And then we basically solve our problem. Any questions so far? I'll leave you like a few seconds to just type those three things. Verify that you can run them. And tell me if like that doesn't work, a package is missing, because I want to solve that right now. Okay, let's move on to duality. That's going to be the heavy technical part of today. Okay, so what I did is I put everything on one line, and I'm going to use through those knots the notation that the five-pointed star describes an optimal solution. Either the optimal objective value or the optimal variables that lead, the optimal feasible solution that leads to that objective value. And when you have like a six-pointed star superscript, it just means that it's a feasible solution, but it's maybe not the optimal one. And often people in optimization, they will work with the extended real line where you add both infinities. And here the convention will be as follows. If we write down that the solution is p plus infinity, and it's a minimization problem, it basically means that no real value exists that satisfies the constraint, so that's a sign that the problem is infeasible. If it's finite, then okay, we are good, we have a feasible solution. And if that p star is minus infinity, basically it means that we can go as far as we want towards like a minimum value, that means the problem is unbounded. Now, of course, computers can't represent in floating point plus infinity minus infinity. So what they could, but yes, yes, yes. But you're not going there, like with, and you're going to have like trouble with cancellation and stuff. So what solvers do is they will have an internal variable that means treat that value as infinity. So maybe it's 10 to the power 6. What it also means is that when you formulate linear and in general like convex problems, you should rescale all your units so that all the intermediate values are close to one. I mean, having a few order of magnitude of difference is not a big deal, but please don't have variables that are like 10 to the power 6 in magnitude. Your solvers are not made for that.
That's a general comment. That's true for other parts as well, because you have only 16 digits in floating point numbers. If you soak up 6 digits by having to rescale variables, then everything else is getting into trouble.
I mean, the thing is, if everything scaled up, in principle, we could write an algorithm because it's floating point, like the decimal point can move. In principle, we could rescale everything and have the algorithm work. It's just that you have those inside tolerances that are going to treat some big number as infinity, and you'll run up into that. Actually, it's not too bad to have like all numbers scaled by a factor. What's really, really bad is if you have like x1 between 0 and 1 and x2 between 10 to the power 6 and 10 to the power 7, and then x3 between like 0.0001. Like that's asking for exactly that loss of precision. Okay, now what we're going to do is to use the probably something we have seen like a long time ago in classical mechanics, the Lagrange multipliers, when we have constraint problems. At least I saw that in classical mechanics, and I had to go back when I got into optimization. So the idea is that to each constraint in the problem, we are going to introduce multipliers that are basically the same dimension as the constraint. They are variables as well. For the ax equal b, so we have, remember, x is of dimension n, and then m is the number of constraints. So the matrix A has m rows and n columns. So number of equality constraints in that thing is going to be m. So the number of Lagrange multipliers for the ax equal b constraint is m. Thus, y in Rm. Now the other constraint, x non-negative, we are also going to introduce Lagrange multipliers for that one, s, but they are in Rn because we have as many constraints as the number of coefficients in x. And then there is this rule that when you introduce Lagrange multipliers, if they correspond to an equality constraint, the Lagrange multiplier is a real number, and if it corresponds to an inequality constraint, they need to be either non-negative or non-positive. I choose signs so that things are mostly, I made the same choice as Mosaic because we don't have to wiggle so much with the signs. So now we just basically take the idea of introducing Lagrange function. The Lagrangian function is to move from a constraint optimization problem to a problem that doesn't have constraints. So here, we are going to have the objective, and then we augment that objective with the constraint. And I think my laptop wants to sleep, but it should not, please. We're going to augment that objective value with the constraint here for both of them. Note the thing is, assume that we have a feasible x in any point y and s for those additional variables. So when I just regroup the term here, and I see that, okay, this part is zero, this part is my original objective, and this part, x is non-negative by assumption of feasibility, and x, s is non-negative because it corresponds to an inequality constraint, so that term is a negative. So the value of that for any feasible x is a lower bound on my objective. Okay, and I should use the PDF so that we have the equation numbers. And you have the PDF as well on the GitHub. So now, okay. The idea now is to fix y and s and minimize x. So we're going to run into two cases. And x is a real number which has a constraint of non-negativity, but that non-negativity constraint is taken care of by a multiplier. So minimize over all real x. So just minimize that Lagrangian function over x. I get this, and regrouping the terms in a slightly different fashion, what I see is that if that thing is non-zero, I can make that minimum as negatively large as possible. Otherwise, like the only sane option, that this term here is zero, in which case I get only that term survives. So we know here that for every y and s, because we define g in that way, this value is going to be a lower bound for the primal objective, because that function is a lower bound on cx. And of course, like, why did I say that thing is zero? Because minus infinity is a stupid lower bound. So if we want a proper lower bound, we need to satisfy that condition. And now we have everything to examine duality. Just going to shift things a little bit downstairs. So we want that constraint to be satisfied. I'm putting it there. By definition of a Lagrange multiplier for an inequality constraint, this is non-negative. And now I'm trying to find kind of the best lower bound I can get. So I'm going to maximize the lower bound, because a good lower bound is as high as possible. And I'm maximizing over the Lagrange multipliers with the constraint so that the bound is not stupid, and I will get some optima. This is actually the dual problem of the linear program that we have seen above. And now, because this is always a lower bound on the primal, we have that the objective of the dual is always a lower bound for the objective of the primal. This is called weak duality, and it holds for every convex program in existence. You can move from linear programs, you can introduce more involved functions. Like the two norm is very popular, leads to second order cone. You can introduce linear matrix inequalities, constraint on eigenvalue of matrices, very popular for us quantum information people. Weak duality is always going to hold. And let's see what we can have and mark down in the conversion, kind of like crap down my nice itemized thing. Anyway, so maybe the dual is unbounded. This maximization, we can make this as high as possible. What it means that plus infinity will be a lower bound for my primal value means that the primal is infeasible. What's really, really fun is that if you see that your primal value when the solver aborts and say, okay, dual unbounded, if you solve the dual problem, it's actually a certificate that the primal is infeasible. You just don't get like something that crashes infeasible. You get actually a certificate of infeasibility. I'm not going to look at certificates of infeasibility in detail. It's in the Mosaic cookbook, really well explained. Another possibility is that the dual is feasible and this objective value is finite. Now, the primal could be feasible or infeasible in principle, because that this finite doesn't mean that P is not infinity. We'll see what it means for the linear program. There's something a bit stronger that we can say. This is very general. And now, if the dual is infeasible, normally we can't conclude much because the primal could still be feasible. But actually, what we have for linear programs, if D optimal is finite, then the primal and dual object optimal value match. And if the primal is finite, optimal value is finite, then the dual matches. So you're either, for linear program in the case, dual infeasible, primal unbounded, dual unbounded, primal infeasible, or both feasible and finite objective value. So, I said that I would talk less today. This is what I'm going to do. So exercise, here I put the constraints so that we have exactly the dual form of the optimization problem we have seen before. What you have to do is to just cut and paste the constraint and see, like, in the primal the objective was feasible, what can we expect for the dual, and see what you get here. I'm going to switch to the Jupyter notebook view. I don't think I need to go around the room to check that everything is going well. I'm just going to cut and paste myself the stuff here. Put it there. Remark that even if y is a scalar variable and just use like the syntax variable 1, it's going to be a scalar. Solving that thing. I'm using convex.maximize because convex.gl can work with that well. Optimal objective, D minus 1. Is that a surprise? Not really. Linear programming, both programs should give the same solution if they are both feasible. And then we get basically the dual variables. There is a whole series of things you can say about dual variables. They tell you if I relax that constraint or my objective is going to move. It's very popular in economics. Like if you can phrase like profit maximization problem as a linear program or as a convex program, then you can see, let's say you have a constraint on the number of machines you have in a factory. You can say, okay, if I added more machines, how would my profits change? They tell you that information. But that's not what I want to do today. We are going to do physics. A lot of physicists go work for hedge funds later. So the thing is, we've seen that convex.jl is very fluid in terms of what it accepts. We can put sum, we can put inequalities in whatever form. What convex.jl is actually going to do is to shuffle variables and constraints internally to map to either the primal or dual form and ask the solver to solve that, get the solution from the solver, shuffle things back, give you back what you need. So you never have to worry about doing transformations manually. What's really cool is that most solvers actually solve the primal and dual problem at the same time. So when you have the primal problem and you solve that, or when you have the dual problem and you solve that, you get information about both. So that enables you, if you see the primal is not converging well, okay, maybe the dual is unbounded. That means actually the primal is infeasible. So the solver will check that information as iteration progresses. Now, of course, now we don't work with exact arithmetic. In the notes of last week, I mentioned that there are a few solvers that work with exact rational arithmetic that may be useful for some problems, but usually our problems are too big for that. So what it means is that instead of returning exactly the exact solution, we will get a floating point approximation. So let's see what happens when the solver doesn't return like P optimal, but P feasible, some feasible solution. And the same for the dual. We don't get the real optimum, but some feasible solution, along with an objective. So now let's look at this primer. If we have a solution that's feasible but not optimal, it means that P will be greater or equal than this one, which is what I have written here. No, the dual problem was a maximization problem. So any solution that's feasible but not optimal will be a lower bound on that. So okay, forget about the equal sign. Just by feasibility and because it's a minimization and maximization, we get those two inequalities. No, on top of that, we have weak duality that provides, and for LP, it's actually an equality here. So we can speak of the optimal objective for both the primal and dual at the same time. So what's going to happen is that if I look at what the solver returns, I know that my true objective is sandwiched between the feasible solution for the primal and the dual. So a lot of people believe that, okay, I can just look at primal objective value, dual objective value, and my optimum will be there. And it's kind of interval arithmetic certified. Actually not. And I've been bitten by that in the past, and colleagues as well. Because what happens is that we are not going to get a feasible solution. We are going to get a solution that's approximately feasible. So maybe we have AX equal B plus epsilon, and epsilon is really, really small. Now what that means is that the fact that feasibility is only approximative means that this only holds approximately. And I've asked people who work on the field, like, can I look at the matrices that define my problem, look at the condition number, and guess, like, okay, my constraints are violated by epsilon, then my objective should not differ by more than an order of magnitude more than that? No. You can always create degenerate instances where, like, slight infeasibility will make the this condition fail horribly. If you want really certified results, there are solvers that use interval arithmetic to post-process the result. Like, ask me about it. I use them. But in general, it works, kind of. Yeah?
Would it be possible to find a different problem expressed in a different set of variables to get some orthogonality in the constraints? Now, I'm thinking from linear algebra. I don't know whether that makes sense.
Yes. Absolutely. So often, like, reformulating the problem so that you don't have duplicate constraints is a great way to make this behave better. But there is no way looking at the problem formulation to guess a priori how good this formulation is. So it's kind of we want to rewrite something, but we don't know what it should look like. I want to tell you something that's not in the slides about that, and I see that I have a bit more time than I expected. Can everybody see that backward? I guess so. Or just a problem for people who are doing I hope they will figure that out. Let's say that you're writing in floating point, something like that. And now, here I'm doing really a stupid example. But such degeneracies in my AX equal B system, they will happen. Okay, I'll take care of the screen later. They will happen because you have degeneracies in that linear system that you haven't denotified. So let's assume that I have like floating point errors there and there. Now, for any epsilon greater than zero, the system is inconsistent. So now, there is a big question if I'm writing a solver. I know that people will not take super care about their models to give me something that don't degenerate. So I have to accept a bit of degeneracy, slight infeasibility. How much should I accept? How big should the epsilon be in that case so that I decide the problem is infeasible? With respect, okay, the user didn't formulate the problem correctly. It's small, so I will accept it. So in general, if you have redundancies in your system of linear constraints, if A is not full rank, that could lead to numerical precision errors. But often solvers are pretty robust. Let's go back to the formulation. So there will be another magic number in the solver. When is infeasibility really, really infeasible? Okay. So the last thing I want to mention about the theory or to use convex programming and so on, is that above, we've wrote the problem once in a primal form, another time in a dual form, and run the solver twice. But actually, you only need to run the problem in one form and ask convex.jl for the dual variables, and you will obtain them for free. So what I will ask you to do is to just cut and paste the prime data in that thing here, run it, and then compare the dual variable you obtain from solving the primal problem to the feasible solution you obtain when solving the dual problem. And that will conclude part one of today's module. Do you have any questions about what we just so far? I will maybe mention one fun thing before moving on to the next part. So until now, we've seen two forms for convex problems. And for a convex program, this needs to be convex. This needs to be convex too. And this needs to be a linear constraint. And for today's lecture, actually, today, we ask that this is linear. This is linear too. And then later on, we move to a different form of the optimization problem that was basically minimize a linear function of the objective such that x is non-negative and ax is equal to b. So that was the canonical form of a linear program. So just a remark, if you have some equation that's of the form ax less or equal than beta, how do you handle that in that notation? You basically do beta minus alpha x is equal to some t, and you ask that t is greater or equal than 0. And now you include the t with the variables x, and this is now an equality constraint. So there are reformulation you can do to map linear problem of that form to linear problems of that form. So what happened in the construction of solvers is that they are very efficient solvers to solve linear problems. You can have millions of variables and constraints. That works well. The bonus thing is that all these companies, they make a lot of money using with hedge funds and businesses, so they give academic licenses for free because they know that the students will move to those hedge funds and ask to use the same software, which is great for us because we have massive amounts of engineering have been invested and those things are fast. If you want to move beyond a linear program, there is something called second order cone problems. It's basically you introduce constraints of the form bounded norm. And then another class, SDPs. Basically, SDPs, you write your variables in a matrix, and then you ask that the eigenvalues of that matrix are non-negative. And SDPs are super expressive. You can express norms with them. You can express a lot of eigenvalues problem with them. You can approximate the logarithm with SDPs as well. So that's for the last 20 years, SDPs were people moved. Mosaic, they decided, okay, we can actually go beyond, and they included two other types of things, exponential function and power functions. And what they did was to formulate that using cones. So when you have a constraint of that form, it's the same thing of saying X is in a set that satisfies this, such that, and that set has the form of a cone. And there are two other types of cones, and if you just include them in a very generic form, you can basically express any convex optimization problem that's known to man. So Mosaic has done that, and they removed the possibility of optimizing over that form. They only allow like very kind of limited forms canonical of that type, but because every prime can be reformulated, everything now can be solved in a very robust way. It's pretty exciting, like things, it's like research that has been done like last year and now available in solvers. Anyway, I'm getting a bit tired of myself. Let's go now to the kind of homework and like all we are going to do physics with linear programs. Going to switch topics. I think I'm going to use the blackboards on the other side just to give a bit of context. Let's say that I have two variables, S, if somebody is smoking, and C, if somebody gets a cancer. It's not a very fun example, but it's the one that you're going to see in every talk. People write causal explanations using arrows. So for example, maybe the causal explanation between those two variables is that there is absolutely no relation, like no arrows. That means that if I look at the probability distribution of those over those variables, as they are not causally related, the distribution should be independent, it should factorize. Or I could say maybe if I get the cancer, I'm really stressed out, so I tend to smoke more. So basically that means that my explanation is going to be P of S, smoking depends on having the cancer or not, and this is like the cause variable does not depend on anything else. Or maybe the reverse, I smoke, therefore I destroy my DNA, and like that's going to be PSC CS. Or maybe the last causal explanation is that there is an underlying cause, maybe my DNA, something in my genes that makes me prone to smoke and get the cancer at the same time. So what I will get is PSC. It's basically a sum of this variable D, or whatever, like the genes, their number from 1 to N or something like that. So there is an underlying distribution that I don't observe. And now C depends on D. And actually, I have bad news for science in that model. It's that those three explanations, if you only have access to the description PSC, they are not distinguishable. Because if you have any description PSC using Bayes' rule, you can write it in this form, and of course, like this is more general. You can also embed like set D equal S. And that maps to this one. So there is no way to distinguish among them. But I like that example because it sets up the way we are going to talk about causal relations. Effects, they depend only on causes in the conditional probability distributions. And they could be variables that I don't observe. Therefore, when I write the model, I have to sum over those values to get the marginal distribution. Okay, this is not an interesting example to falsify because all this, like the only theory I can falsify is this one. And actually, I can use experimental data to falsify this one. But now there is something interesting that we'll use linear programming that has been done at PI 4 years ago. I really like that I'm doing a lecture and I'm using like actual research, like papers been published last year. So now my causal structure is going to be this one. Okay, and I have to tell my colleague Ellie that there should be a circle here. Anyway, I have three variables that are binary. They take values 0, 1, A, B, and C. If those three variables depended on a common cause, like something in the middle that everybody would depend on, I can achieve every distribution P ABC, because I just put the values of ABC inside that common thing, and I have a trivial model. But now if I say, okay, ABC, they only depend on information that they share only with another effect, another variable, then maybe I get something non-trivial. So you get this. Another question, if I have such a model, can I get something perfectly correlated? Again, if I had a bit that that's common to A, B, and C, I just say P, A, given that an absurd thing should be the same value, and I can realize that very easily. But now we don't know. Like, can I really show that this is compatible or incompatible with this? Seems to be quite a simple problem. Then people realize, oh, it's actually a hard problem. And then Ali Wolf and people at PI realize, oh, we can map that to linear programs. You see, it's pretty interesting. So blah, 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 what I put here is F3 on a variable. They will be described by some underlying distribution that I don't know. The variable A will depend only on X and Y. The variable B will only depend on Y and Z. And the variable C will only depend on X and Z, such that my model is this. Or should I test that? OK. Actually, I can't using an optimization program without doing a bit of thinking, because I don't know what's the cardinality of X, Y, and Z. Or worse, X, Y, Z could be real numbers. And now we have to work not with probability distributions, but with densities or something like that. Actually, you can always, in that problem, you can always prove that those X, Y, Z, they can always be restricted to integers between 1 and 6. But even if you do that, then OK, now you have how many variables? Let's say they can take 6 values. P of X, P of Y, P of Z, 6 coefficients each. Then P of A given X, Y, 6 squared times 2, 72 times 3. That's around like 100 and something variables, with a polynomial that looks like degree 6 polynomial. Try to put that in Mathematica. Mathematica will like tell you to go home. Like, there's no way you can solve that. There are ways to massage that problem to get a polynomial of degree 3. Reduce a bit the number of variables, because P of A is equal to 1 minus P of, like the other one. Like, you can use like fact that probability sum to 1. But it's still a horrible problem. So we're going to do something else. And at PI, people developed the inflation technique. And the inflation technique is this. OK, I have my P that's perfectly correlated. And I assume that there is a model of that form. It's like limited shared information between variables. And what I'm going to say, OK, if the model above exists, what I can do is actually I can decouple one of the unobserved variables, make a copy of it. And now we'll have like Y1 and Y2. Y1 will have exactly the same distribution of Y2, but they will be independent. And I get that thing. Now, if I unfold that figure, I will get that line over there. Of course, what I have to realize now is that this will not have reproduced the same correlations as the model above, because I changed the way things are wired. But still, there will be a few interesting things. It's a lot of equation. I will do that with a stick. Can I get both pictures on the same screen? I think I can cheat and do that using the PDF. Where is it? Hey, come here. OK, let's compare things. OK. What happens if I hide B here, and I hide B here. The thing is that the two graph, and by hiding B, I mean I forget about the value of B. Then I actually, because the other variables that don't depend on Y, the value of Y becomes irrelevant. So you can basically remove these two things. We'll see in the probability description what that mathematically it holds. And if I remove B here, I basically get in the two models exactly the same graph. So what does it mean? it means that if I only look at the correlation of AC, both models will reproduce exactly the same thing. Now, what happens if I remove A here, and I remove A and Y2 because I won't need Y2? Both models will reproduce the same thing. The last, and this is basically what I'm doing in a very mathy way here. That's the correlation of the inflated scenario, the one where I made a copy. And here, I look at what happens if I sum over B1, then I get that expression. I don't need Y1 like will decouple. I can sum over it as well. And I can look that this expression has exactly the same shape as the one in the original scenario when I sum over B. Same variables in both. So now what I can say is that I have equality relations between my original model and my model in the inflation. I have those equality constraints. Same thing for BC, you see. Now what happens if we remove C1? I need to do a bit of back and forth here. Okay. Here, if I remove C1, then basically the graph decouples. And now because I have no causal relation between the two subgraphs, A2 can't be correlated with B1, like in the example over there, except with a bit more variables. So now what I can say is that PA2B1 will factorize, but now A2 alone matches the original graph. Like, if in the original graph, I remove B and C, I get basically A with the two parents X and Y. That's exactly what I have here in that subgraph. Same thing, if I keep only B and remove A and C, I will have B and the two parents X and Y and Z, which is what I have here. So now I can write the constraint P of AB, A2B1, IJ is equal to P AB, YJ like this. What I was careful of is when I match the original and the inflated scenario, I use like domain, this is YJK instead of ABC to avoid confusion. So now let's copy all those things together. I have three equality constraints. And of course, by assumption, if I have a model for my inflation, if I am a model for that inflated scenario, I don't know what the PA2C1B1 will be, but I know that it's a probability distribution. It should be non-negative. So this is what I've write on the right. Three families of equality constraints, a non-negativity constraint. Is it a linear program? Okay, you could say, this looks linear, this looks linear, this is not. It's a quadratic term. But now the thing is, we know exactly which P, A, B, C we are testing. So those things, they are not variables on the right-hand side. They are constants. So we can basically compute them. We can define the P, A, 2, B, 1, C, 1 as variables and solve that LP. And this is what we are going to do. That's basically the exercise. So we have like a quarter of an hour remaining. Like the first part of the homework is to write down using convex.jl the linear program that corresponds to this. We can start doing the lecture here. That's what I suggest. And then I will show you like what are the questions. What I did just below here is wrap up this in a certain way so that this form corresponds to what you have in the paper, because these examples come from the paper. And I put a bit of blah blah here. The solver will either tell us the problem is feasible or it's infeasible. And when it's infeasible, there is no proof by contradiction that our correlation can't be achieved with the original model. Things go like this. Assume that I had a model in the original scenario. Then by construction, I have a model in that inflation scenario. Now what I'm proving that there was a contradiction in that inflated scenario, and now I use this. If A implies B, not B implies not A, then I prove causal incompatibility. So we have to check if that program is infeasible. It should be, actually. So blah, 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 homework. First thing, verify that the distribution is compatible with that inflation. It should not. A small note, sometimes when you have a solver saying it's infeasible, you don't know if it's because you have like numerical problems or if the problem is really infeasible. What I like is to transform a feasibility problem into a maximization problem. Instead of putting zero, you put Z. You maximize that thing. If you get a Z that's non-negative, you know the problem is feasible. If you get a Z that's negative, you know it's infeasible. But no, you always get a feasible solution, which is sometimes better numerically. Homework two, just use a parameterized version of the distribution. Check for which values you have like compatibility or not. This is another distribution. Check compatibility as well. And this is kind of like an optional a choice. You can either implement a slightly more complicated inflation scenario or retrieve the dual variable and interpret them, like see what they mean in that context. So point two is going to be straightforward but a bit lengthy, and point one is more interesting, like that would lead to theory, but you will have to dig a little bit in the paper, in the cookbook. Are there any questions about like the question? If not, I suggest we start, and I will like go around to make sure that you can get like question one. And then it's like Eric that handles kind of like the how you go back, like bring back homework solution, like the standard 2 week. I'll be at PI during that time, so like come anytime. I don't think we want to fail anybody in that course. Like we really want to push you towards like getting something done. Yeah, and it's and that research that had been done at PI is a great application of duality, so and context programming. So I really love it that I can give you a toy problem that's an actual research paper. Let's start and see what happens. Where did I put it? A causal inference paper here. And you go to Appendix B. You basically get the like an enumeration of the PABC in the inflation and all that relates to the submarginals here, and you have the matrix. So that's at least like one part you can totally steal from the paper. At the beginning of those lecture notes, I'm telling you here what to read. The paper is pretty amazing, but it can get highly technical. But if you just read the examples, everything should make sense. That's what I always advise students, like read the examples, skip all the definitions.